The following is a presentation of the Cold Slither Podcast Network. The Cold Slither, you'll be joining us
soon. Good evening, Rick. Would you believe it's Dr. Doom?
What's on your evil mind?
Oh, you insulting tongue, it mocked my words well.
How about this rumor that you are really hired, Mr. Stark?
And welcome to another exciting episode of the Click Nations Comic Book Chronicles. I am your host, Tim D-O-double-G. Tonight I'm joined by my co-host, at Agent underscore 70 on Twitter.
What's up, everybody?
Also got here, at PCN underscore dirt on Twitter.
Yeah!
My bottom third is working. See, I finally got it working.
After a month. And we also have at Roddy Cat on Twitter.
I am here.
And we have a very special guest here with us tonight. We have the current artist on Marvel's Secret Wars Runaways series, Sanford Green.
I was starting to feel some kind of weight. I was waiting for my special effects with the crowd chair. There was a delay, and I was like, oh man, I'm not going to get that. Okay, yeah, I see how it is. It's like,
that's how we get out. That's how we new guy.
I'm the outsider. That's okay.
See, because I've already got everyone's timing down, so I'm waiting for you to do, you know, say, you know, hello, and then hit the trumpet.
Oh well, you know, I tell you what, you know, that this goes to show that I'm not a pro at this at all. So bear with me.
No problem.
So yes. Thanks. Thank you, Sanford, for joining us tonight. We won't keep you too long. We just want to talk with you, get to find out some of the ins and outs of what life is like for comic book artists and how you got your break and whatnot. But if you can, real quick, just give people a quick introduction for yourself.
Well, like you guys said, I'm Sanford Green. I've been working professionally now for the past 12 plus years, and I've done everything from and by no means when I say this that doesn't mean that I've been working on these big time books for a long period of time, but I've touched my pencil to paper on titles like Batman, Superman. I've done some Star Wars stuff before, which that was pretty exciting. That was back at Dark Horse. I can go back really quick and just mention that my first bit of professional work was I was drawing monkeys, to be honest with you. This known property called the Planet of the Apes. I'm pretty sure you guys are familiar with that. And this was actually the Tim Burton version of Planet of the Apes, the one that everyone wants to forget.
Wow.
So I when that movie came out, we Dark Horse contacted me because I submitted my portfolio a few months earlier, and they said, hey, we got this cool new property, well-known property, Planet of the Apes, we'd be interested in that. I was just interested in anything. It could have been, you know, Stickman. I would have been excited about that. So, hey.
You got to get paid. I love it. Pay those bills.
You got to pay the bills, man. And, you know, it was my first opportunity on a professional level, so that was a no-brainer for me. So started there. This is back in 2002, 2003. And then shortly after that, I did some Star Wars stuff. And, you know, slowly but surely, the opportunities kept coming. I started on some DC stuff shortly after that, did some Superman stuff. I did a lot of their remember that Johnny DC line that came out? They had all of the Cartoon Network. They basically did comic versions of the Cartoon Network series, the different series, especially the DC stuff, Legion of Superheroes, of course, right. Justice League, some various other titles. But I did a lot of work for that. And then Batman, the animated series, came out. And not the Tim Burton. I'm sorry, not the Bruce Timm version. It was the other version that a lot of people were kind of weary about.
Was it the Batman?
The Batman. Yeah, I loved it. I thought it was awesome.
Yeah, I liked that show a lot.
Yeah, I liked that.
Yeah, that show was... Yeah, yeah,
Joker in that one, but I thought the show was good.
Yeah, yeah, I love that Joker. That Joker is like, of course he would be in a straitjacket, you know. But hey, that's just my taste, I guess. But you know, I did a lot of work on that, on the comic version of that, and shortly after that, that's when, you know, the real break started for me, where I got a miniseries called Wonder Girl. And, you know, it kind of took off from there. To be honest with you, that was around 2007, 2008. And, you know, I guess fast forward up to now, I've done various other titles over at Marvel, Spider-Man, and I did some X-Men stuff. Back then, it was very easy for you to do the young versions of these characters. They had these young reader versions of the characters. You know, Spider-Man was a part of this Marvel had a line called what was it called? Marvel Age? I think it was called Marvel Age. And that was for, you know, the younger readers. But shortly after that, I got weary of drawing, you know, all the young reader stuff. Mm. I didn't want to be pigeonholed into that. And, you know, I just decided to, you know, reinvent myself. This is right around the time where a lot of artists were doing that. This is around 2008 or 9. And they started to reinvent themselves. So, you know, that's what I did. You know, I did that as well. A lot of guys like, you know, some of the mainstay guys like Scotty Young and, even Roberto Ramos. A lot of guys that had that cartoony style, we'll call it what it is. There's so much of us, you know, coming around, but there wasn't a whole lot of opportunities other than doing these young reader versions of these comics. So shortly after that, that's what I did. I just reinvented myself as well. So, you know, and I guess I could share about that shortly.
All right.
Sorry, I was kind of rambling there. Sorry about that.
No, it's cool. It's all good because unfortunately that's sort of where, you know, that type of, you know, like, let's recap your whole career type question goes.
Yeah. That's pretty much what that was the question. I was like, okay, I could be very short and create this awkward silence by being short, or I could, you know. So,
go right ahead.
Now, actually, it prompted another question for me early on. You said you submitted to Dark Horse and got the Planet of the Apes series. What was was that like at a point in time where you were sending submissions to numerous publishers?
Yeah, I'd sent stuff to, you know, all the major companies, and Dark Horse was the first to bite. And, you know, and that's usually how it is. You're going to get more, you'll get a quicker response from, you know, the companies that aren't necessarily Marvel or DC. So, you know, they were the first. Now, I mean, and don't get me wrong, Dark Horse is no slouch. So
yeah,
it was
right.
Really cool that my first professional work was, you know, from
a major publisher. Yeah.
The next biggest publisher out there. So
cool. I was going to ask, who do you count amongst your major influences art-wise?
Oh,
in terms
wow.
of either individual comic artists or, you know, any particular style or, you know, maybe a manga influence. So,
well, you know, it's interesting. I guess that kind of goes back to what I said a few minutes ago about reinventing myself, because mm-hmm. earlier on it was that manga anime influence in there, right? I was very influenced by Joe Madd. I think every artist from that era, mm-hmm. The early, the mid-90s, on to the early 2000s, you know, he could do no wrong at that time. And that was my biggest influence, I think, from that beginning. And then I would say, you know, just animation in general. Animation in general is very, very big for me, still is.
Sure.
But when I started to reinvent myself, I really started getting into what I've been. I guess it was kind of a sub conscious influence for me, and that was like urban culture. Mm-hmm. I always was into it, but I never realized how much my art was affected by it. So I really started to cater towards that even more. But once I realized how much I was using my that urban influence as a guide for me artistically, that also kind of helped me to see what I just noticed a lot of other artists reinventing themselves, and you know they would make mention to a lot of these classical strip artists, the comic strip artists. Mm-hmm. Guys like Milton Caniff, Alex Raymond, you know, and it's just the list just keeps going. You know, these guys, Al Williamson, you know, all these guys, I started to research, and I was like, wow, these guys really are pretty powerful guys in terms of how they had so much control over their craft, and they did it all. They did the brushwork. They didn't just pencil. And I think, but what you could see in their work was if you could pull back the pen and ink side of it and just see the drawing, you realize that these guys they're cartoony, but there's something there that cloaks that cartooniness, and it's honestly the brushwork right. Was it had this, I don't know why, it just made the viewer take that style a little more seriously. Guys like, one of the greats with Will Eisner. I mean, mm-hmm. Look at his style and look at where he went with his style in terms of the direction. Alex Toth, same thing. You know, these guys were very, if you strip away all the brushwork, very simple, very, again, the word cartoony style, mm-hmm. But that light and shadow, that brush rendering technique really helped to make it feel like it was more than just a simple style, if you will. And sure. it was never simple. It's just it's that illusion, you know, of again that light and shadow that really kind of made made those illustrations feel even more serious.
Sure. I was gonna let the art geek kind of jump out and say and add on that, you know, a lot of people joke about how inkers are simply tracers, but I think that, you know, a brush and ink and a deft pen can really add depth and character to a lot, to even the simplest pencil drawing. And I think that's where, you know, a powerful inker, you know, truly embellishes and enhances, you know, even the simplest line work. So, you know, I definitely agree with you that, you know, while the base may be very simplistic, you know, you add on that ink and you take control of how the shade is applied, it, you know, it really adds to the art. And, you know, I can't say that I've been following your career and seeing the progression, but I can definitely see that, you know, you've kind of adopted a lot of the more like detail oriented like superhero stuff to make it more, you know, I hate to say mainstream, but it does look like superhero work. You know, like I'm looking at like a page of Uncanny Avengers, and I remember reading this and thinking, well, you know, this is a great Uncanny Avengers page. There's nothing, you know, it's absolutely, you know, it's well rendered. Nothing overly cartoony about it. It's great superhero work.
Right. Thanks. I appreciate that. But yeah, that's. Honestly, you know, again, you know, over the last 4 years, three, 4 years, those influences have shifted tremendously, to be honest with you. I mean, manga is really kind of the last line of influence for me. That first line is those classical illustrators or those strip artists. I'm really into this illustrator. He was the illustrator for Modesty Blaze. I don't know if you guys are familiar with Modesty Blaze. This is an old European, I think it was published. It's basically a strip that came out in, it was a British comic strip.
Okay.
And it was turned into a TV show. It's pretty much a female James Bond is pretty much what it is. And okay. I have a collection of those strips. Tomorrow's Publishing did a few volumes of the, I'm sorry, not Tomorrow's Publishing, Flesk those guys are pretty good. Flesk and Titan Books. They're very good at they're pretty good at collecting a lot of these old strips and putting them out. As a matter of fact, His Modesty Blaze is something that I'm going to really start to apply in my new project that I'm working on. Jim Haldaway is the artist, actually, for that Modesty Blaze comic strip. But that strip, once I saw those illustrations, I was just absolutely floored. I haven't thought about buying a few of the originals. I went to Comic-Con this year and went over to a dealer that had a lot of the old strip artists' originals. And, man, I mean, three panels. Mm-hmm. We're talking, you know, eight and a half by 12, something like that. They're like $2,500, you know.
Wow.
Yeah, wow. So, you know.
I definitely see, I see this now. I mean, I was just going to, I mean, what's funny is that every time I speak to an artist, I keep wanting to jump out and say, what, you didn't sit there and, like, try to ape George Perez New Teen Titans like I used to try, you know, you know, like back in the day when I was, you know, like growing up?
Yeah. Well, you know, honestly, you know, his, of course, you know, Crisis on Infinite Earths was, that was one of the first comics I ever got. Well, the first that really impacted me.
Sure.
So yeah, I mean, everyone I think was trying to understand as a kid, how does he draw these characters? Oh God, man, my brain hurt when I saw that. I thought you drew that small, first of all.
Yeah, and I used to always think that too.
You know,
well, you know, he does draw that small. Like he draws with like a 0.3 lead. I've read that in some of his interviews, and some of his old inkers are like, "What the heck are you drawing with? He crams so much onto a page."
Yeah, I mean, but
you pick up a 0.3, you know, a 0.3 mechanical pencil, you start drawing with it, you'd be like, what the heck?
Well, even with that, I would already drink. The way that his page is laid out. His page, honestly, though, is like, I think it's like 12 by 18 or bigger.
Right.
So technically, he's still drawing small, but not as small. Like even though it's a 0.3 lead, he's on a big page. So he's still, you know, he has more room than you realize. But it's still amazing, man. This stuff is
sure.
Amazing.
All right, cool. So I wanted to actually touch on something. But Tim, do you have another topic that you wanted to hit on?
No, go ahead.
Well, I wanted, because I was listening to an interview you did with John Suntress on Word Balloon, the podcast. Quick plug for you and for John Suntress. And you know, you're one of the contributors to the Marvel hip hop covers,
right?
And I just wanted to touch on a couple of the items that that you had, you know, kind of touched on before. We've already discussed this on the show about, you know, some of the influences that we've had and how, you know, that, I mean, some of the musical influences that we've had growing up and seeing some of these covers being recreated, you know, some mm-hmm. of the cultural things that you know that have been kind of discussed that came up out of this. Would you could you talk about some of that and how you feel about how some of that's been portrayed in the media, or at least through bloggers?
Yeah, well, man, you guys are asking some very detailed questions that you can't give a simple answer for any of these things, to be honest with you. I mean, honestly, I touched. I went in some detail on just my personal experience mm-hmm. in this industry, because honestly, that's the only way that I could. If you want to identify with a lot of what's happening in this industry, you have to first look at how it identifies to you. You have to be real with how it makes you feel, and I think a lot of people are identifying with it and how it makes them feel, whether it's positive or negative. I do think that there's ramifications for how you handle that. You know, I guess you're touching. I guess you kind of touched on how the media, I guess, is mm-hmm. portraying it. Overall, the media has just been outstanding with this thing. I mean, I will tell you this: this thing is reaching places that I don't think comics has really reached in a very long time. When you start seeing, you know, every hip hop blog or music blog or music site that's out there has talked about this and highlighted this. There are radios, major radio stations. I can't go into detail right now, but there's going to be a major, interview, exclusive interview happening with a major radio station with
cough cough hot 97 cough, cough power 105.1 cough cough 107.5 BLS. Sorry, we're kind of narrowing it down if it's New York.
I was gonna say
he didn't say it was New York. He said a major radio station.
I did, and that is correct. I did say it could be anywhere, and that's why the internet is so great, because you know it's not you can't just put things in a box anymore. Unfortunately, that works the other way as well, where, you know, if someone or there's a certain chatter that's happening about something that's negative, then that can build over time as well. Not even over time. It can build instantly. And I do know that there's some people that are disgruntled by what's happening with the Marvel stuff. But I tell people this, mainly for me, knowing my just touching on my experiences first, let me just say that with my experiences coming in this industry, that it's a no-brainer that in terms of the upper tier management, editorial, those positions of that in that area,
right,
on that level, there's not a lot of African Americans. There's not a lot of women. You know,
right.
There's not a lot. You know, let's just be real. It's, you know, middle class Caucasians, male Caucasians. So, you know, but that's, you know, that's not a secret or, oh, no, don't mention it. I mean, every editor that I've worked with has been, with the exception of one in my career, has all been Caucasian males.
Right.
Actually, and I take that back. I did work with a Caucasian female once and an African-American once, but everyone else has all been male. So, but still, whether it's at one time or no time, it's clearly dominated by Caucasian males. So, and honestly, the creative side is dominated at one point in time, that is, mm-hmm, coming through by Caucasian males. So, what, I am sorry.
No, no, I was just going to say, you know, I wanted to sort of direct the conversation because I didn't want to kind of retread what you did. You know, all due respect to Word Balloon. You know,
right.
I wanted to just, you know, kind of touch on a couple of things that you spoke about, you know, coming up as an Asian American. And, you know, I didn't realize that some of the creators that I followed growing up were, you know, obviously George Perez, you could tell, is Hispanic, is Latino. But you know,
right,
in terms of, you know, like I came up late 80s, early 90s reading a lot of, you know, X-Men. And all of a sudden, Jim Lee came on the scene. I was like, wait, this is an Asian dude. Wiles Portacio, who I didn't recognize to be anything, but, you know, I thought the dude was Italian. He turns out to be Filipino. So it made, right. So it made a difference for me to see that, you know what, there are Asian dudes out there, you know, creating comics, you know, like really becoming coming to the forefront of comics and really churning out the stuff. I had no idea that Larry Hama was Asian.
You know,
he's the one that created, you know, like G.I. Joe for an entire generation. But
right,
you know, coming up, you know, understanding then that, you know, there were people who, you know, who had a similar background, who were creating the comics that I was enjoying, you know, did make a difference to me. And
right,
you know, it changed the experience for me. And I can definitely understand, you know, coming up, you know, from that perspective, that it did, you know, that it did make something of a difference. But at the same time, I still had to enjoy their work.
Right.
So
yeah, absolutely.
You know, so, you know, I just wanted to say that, you know, it does make a difference to see more, you know, African-American creators in the industry. You know, I think so. You know, having seen, you know, just a small trickle come up, I think it's important that, you know, that more and more that, you know, more representation come up, you know, through the ranks, you know,
right,
through, I would like to say through merit. You know, and
yeah, right,
across,
right,
you know, come across and represent, you know, and you know, now I'm starting to ramble because I've got so much I want to touch on. So,
no, I can totally relate to that. I mean, I shared this on the Word Balloon interview about you know, similar impacting moments for me coming up as a fan. You know, when I saw that you know, this milestone comic line that was formed over at DC Comics, mm-hmm, First of all, you see the characters, and they're, you know, brown skin, you know, male and female characters, and then you realize, you know, thanks to Wizard Magazine, that wait a minute, these guys are, you know, you see this big article, they had this big triple page spread of all of them at a studio. I don't know if you guys ever saw that issue, but I was blown away. I was absolutely blown away. I was like, wow. Sure. And that was all I needed to see, really. And yeah.
This is all sort of pre-internet, right? Because now we can see who the creators are. But back then, I definitely know what you're talking about.
Oh yeah, Wizard was the internet for the most part. I mean, they were the comic book resources and the
Midorama and
they were all of that. So you know, there was one reliable source, if you will, and that was it. And you know, that's all I needed to see was that these guys were, you know, brown skin, you know, males, sure. young guys. So yeah.
Sure. Well, I just wanted to also just ask. It's obvious that, you know, from your interview that you're a fan of hip hop, and you know, we've discussed this at length. What album covers are you? I don't want to spoil too much because obviously you're in the know. Are there any album covers that you would like to see recreated on on these Marvel covers that maybe haven't been announced yet?
Yeah, if I say yeah. What I would like to see for that. Yeah,
because I know it's like because I kept rewording it, thinking, oh, he can't spoil this, he can't drop this, because I know you're in the know. I love the De La cover that you did.
Thanks.
You know, some of us are you know, we've kind of bandied about in our own private chat, like where's this album. So you know,
well, why don't you tell me what would you like to see?
Disappointed that, you know, I read Axel Alonso say that they wanted to restrict it to one album per artist, so they picked one of my all-time favorite covers, Midnight Marauders for Amazing Spider-Man, and right. But I would have loved to see Low End Theory. I would have loved to see
Yeah.
I would love to see somebody adapt that. So,
yeah.
You know, like it's like you got, especially with some of the more, I mean, listen, I grew up broke, so I didn't get to buy any of these albums. So, you know, like going to the record store, that was like the only time I ever saw these album covers. So, like a lot of them are very, you know, without the internet, I wouldn't really understand what they looked like.
Right. What record store?
Oh, for me, Tower Records, Sam okay. Goody. Come on, I'm old school.
my dad used to work at Camelot Music.
Oh, yes.
Oh, man. Really old school.
Wow, that is old school.
Yeah, really.
What, have you ever heard of Fat Beats? Fat Beats was...
I've heard of it.
Yeah, that's actually in Midtown or Uptown. It used to be. It was... Man, that's where, okay, that record store is closed now.
Yeah.
And I'm talking like I'm a native New Yorker, but the reason why I know all this is because a good friend of mine, who's a he's pretty well-known DJ, I don't want to necessarily say his name right now, but he used to be the manager of that store, and he brought in, before these guys blew up, Eminem, Kanye West, Wu-Tang Clan, all these guys were on the verge of being megastars, right? And they would do these in stores. They would perform. So he's posting, I should say, in the over the last year, all these rare video clips of them performing in their infancy in the store. It's pretty amazing. At the end of this, I could send you guys a link. You awesome. Can check it out. Yeah,
please.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
The one thing that I was kind of disappointed in is one of the albums I always enjoyed was EPMD, and they did. Was it Business as Usual? I think was the one that Bill Sienkiewicz did the cover of.
Yeah,
And I thought that would have been great if they would get Bill Sienkiewicz to come in and redo that cover, but yeah, as cover. One of the Marvel covers, like that would have been the ultimate meta, double trip thing. And it just seemed like for whatever reason it never occurred to him, or it didn't make it happen.
Well, never say never. I can say that.
Uh oh. Wait, we have a sound effect. We have a sound effect, Sanford, for this. It's called the spoiler bell.
Exclusive.
Well,
Now, when I say that, that doesn't mean it's happening at all. Don't buy into it. But I can say never say never. You can say, hey, they need to do one of the two live crew, and I'm like, hey, never say never.
We certainly there could be a chance.
Yeah, what you're saying, there is a chance. One in a million. So there is a chance.
I love it. Oh, no. All right. is there a particular cover that you like that you didn't work on that's been announced so far?
Oh, wow. Well, definitely the Midnight Marauders Spider-Man was mm-hmm. – that one really got me. I was super excited. There's a few coming up that I'm like, oh, man, people are going to flip their lids when they see this thing. I love the A-Force, the one that did the
NWA.
The NWA one was pretty sweet. Of course, that's Adam Hughes, so
sure. I can tell you that I never planned on picking up Spider-Man Deadpool, but when they did Paid in Full as the cover, I'm like, I guess that's the one issue of Spider-Man Deadpool that I'm picking up. You know, one of the seminal albums of all time. You can't not pick that. You have to pick that one.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, and it's funny because that was the first one that got that was shown to me. I was going to say got leaked. I'm treating this like the old school, you know, album. Okay. But it was the first one that I saw. They showed me, Marvel showed me that one, and that really got me juiced for where this was going. So, yeah.
Isn't it great that something like this can create so much excitement in you? You know, you're a veteran creator now. And right. To have something like this just kind of come and like really, put some, you know, inject you with some excitement. I wanted to say PEDs really, but you know, like really get the juices flowing.
Oh, the juices are definitely flowing. You know, there's a few more that are coming out that I'm excited about. I'm doing a few more as well. One I'm really excited about. That's the only hint I can give you. So, I'm really looking forward to where this is going to take us. And I said this, I keep referring back to the Word Balloon interview, but this is honestly a launching pad for where Marvel is really going. A lot of people, I shouldn't say a lot of people, but there's a handful of people that felt like, okay, do this little token gimmicky thing, bring in these minority creators and ship them off after this gimmick is over. That's not the case. That this is a launching pad to open the door for a lot of creators. So
that's exciting.
Yeah, that is exciting.
That was one of my big things from at least the initial response from the whatever the maybe 10 plus covers that were released before. Everyone was just going off just the first list. I'm like, I'm pretty sure there's probably more to come. Just be patient, people.
Right. Well, how so? They were looking at it as how?
Oh, not having enough, diversity as far as the people
creating those.
Creating the covers.
I will. Yeah. Again, there's a lot of diverse people that are going to be working on these, and that's not the end of them working at Marvel. So
that's good to hear.
Yep.
Absolutely.
Yeah. I told a gentleman that we had a personal conversation because there was a lot of negative energy coming from this individual. And I just told him, personally, I said, hey, just now is the time. If you feel like this is an injustice, or I shouldn't say an injustice, but is this totally just a lopsided, venture, just hold on. And you'll see where this is going. Give it by 6 months from now, you're going to really see some. When you see Marvel say all new, all different, they're not kidding when they say that. So
nice.
I can say that with confidence.
Cool. do you play any music while you're drawing? Do you like kind of have like a soundtrack? Because I know that I've talked to Damian Scott, and I know that he likes to play, like 90s hip hop. When he's drawing.
You know what's funny? I listen to NPR when I'm working.
Nice.
You know, there's a really cool podcast on NPR called, let me see.
Is it Microphone Check?
Microphone Check. Thank you.
Yeah.
Yeah, I love it. I love it. I love that podcast a lot.
Yeah, so do So, for anybody who don't know, it's NPR's hip hop podcast.
No kidding.
With Ali Shaheed Muhammad and Franny Kelly.
No kidding.
Yeah.
Well, listen, this is what you learn on the Comic Book Chronicles, ladies and gentlemen. I had no idea.
I'll be here all weekend.
Nice.
I was going to ask another, since you Agent 70 brought up the, what do you listen to while you create? What's a typical work day for you as far as, what time you wake up and maybe tend to the personal matters and then start working to, I guess, when your day may typically end?
Man, if I go into detail with this, you will be like, oh, my God, dude, how do you even find time to draw?
Because I always find that interesting with creators. Everyone is different.
Right, especially from the freelance perspective, too,
Right. Well, I have two boys. I have a soon-to-be 14-year-old.
Wow.
Yeah. He plays sports, and my soon-to-be 8-year-old, he also plays sports. So, I'm doing a lot of, I'm just trying to take care of them. And my wife as well. She's stay-at-home mom, so she helps a lot in that regard. But, typical day is just getting up, getting them ready, school. I also, this is another part of my profession that I don't talk enough about, and that is me being a professor. I teach at a local school here called Benedict College Historical.
HBCU.
There you go. We're pretty well known in this area, but I'm a professor there. I teach digital illustration there. I teach kids how to draw on a Cintiq, pretty much. They got to learn how to draw first. You can't come to my class unless you know how to draw. It's pointless if you come in there. But get the kids ready, send them off to school. I go to, take them to school, get back here. By 9 o'clock, 9:30, I'm rolling. By the time I finish all my whatever internet trolling and whatnot, that's the hardest thing right there, man. And I really got to be more careful with my schedule because it's so busy and so tight right now. I'm pretty much doing two full-time professions, professor and then illustrator. I get going, and by, 4, I'm picking up my kids from school. I get back here, and I do a little bit more work. And by 6, 7 o'clock, I'm doing the dinner thing. And honestly, right around this time, 10 o'clock, I'm back at it at work. So, hint, hint.
We won't keep you much longer.
I kid. Not really, no.
So real quick,
like this page ain't creating itself, people.
Yeah, really. So you kind of answered a question that I kind of had as far as your process. You are pretty much strictly digital at this point, right? So you don't just start by hand and then go digital, right?
Oh no, I do. I do. It's half and half now. I do digital first, and then I translate that to traditional.
Okay.
And, So I basically, real quick, my process is I do all my layouts and rough design work and all that stuff digitally. That way I can really, editing and all that stuff is so much easier because you can do so much quicker. You can do it so much quicker from a digital standpoint. Then once I have everything where I want it and I feel good about, then I print that out, blue line, on a piece of Strathmore Bristol illustration board, and then I go in to tighten up the pencil drawing because my layout sketches are loose enough to where I still need to go and do some tightening on the drawing traditionally, and then I ink it traditionally, then scan that back in, and then color it. So clean it up and then do some color. So I saw you guys post. I'm sorry.
No, I was just going to say, the feel of pencil to paper. There's something tactile about, the tactile sensation that you still can't replace by doing it on digital.
Right. Yeah, definitely. The brush, I love doing the brush. And a lot of guys do traditional when it comes to, for that reason.
Well, and also, I was listening to a conversation one time with Freddie Williams, and he does a lot of his stuff digital. But he was saying he goes through every so often, and key pages, when he pencils, he does the pencils on them, he will print them out and ink them, because otherwise, when you go to conventions, you don't have anything to sell.
Hmm.
If everything's 100% digital, you can't make that extra dollar at the con, you know, selling your work. So he's got to keep that in his flow somewhere, just because it adds that extra element.
Well, and to be honest with you, even with that, there's a growing, I guess, mindset that that's not even that big of a deal anymore to have original work at. And I'm not saying that it's completely unanimous or whatever, but there's a growing consensus that, you know what, these pages, you know, unless it's a splash page or a cover or something like that, they usually don't sell for that much anyway. The market overall, unless you're doing some insanely popular book, okay, if you're Stuart Eminem working on Star Wars, every page is probably going to be, you know, anywhere between $300 to $1,000 or more or whatever, you know? So, but for the most part, if you're working on, you know, issue number 43 of Legion of Superheroes, or, you know, some spinoff of some Spider-Man, you know, Silk or whatever, you know, whatever character that's not top of the line.
Spider-Gwen, right.
Or not Spider-Gwen. You know, it's like, you know, those pages aren't going to go for a whole lot. I mean, so you just kind of start to realize that, okay, I can honestly make more money because I'll have my production rate will speed up if I go digital. If you really think about that, because that's what a lot of people are thinking. Their mindsets are starting to change to go that direction now. So again, that, you know, I'm starting to think in that realm as well. I'm not there yet. Every page is inked traditionally, but you know, I got this Cintiq here, and you know, you can use it for a lot of things now, more than just, you know, storyboarding. That's what Cintiqs were originally for, was the storyboard for animation. But now, you know, it's pretty much a canvas for anything art-related.
All right. Oh, cool. Like, we took the conversation full circle.
There you go.
We absolutely took that full circle.
Is there any other questions anyone else had?
Actually, I got a couple of real quick ones. I saw you at Heroes Con recently.
Yeah, yeah.
And
this is all your fault.
you did this.
Excuse me. I think you had one of your students with you, if I'm not mistaken. Was that your first time at Heroes Con or not?
Was that my first time?
Yeah.
Oh, no, dude, I've been going to Heroes Con for like,
because this is only my second, so that's I did.
Okay.
And was that go ahead.
That was his third, I think, second or third, and, you know, my like 15th.
I got you. Yeah.
I'm a mainstay there, man. they pretty much built the convention center around me, and I just stayed there, man. Hey. You're all weekend.
Yeah. All right. And you were also a part of the probably one of my favorite panels at that one, the Variant Cover one, which was not very traveled, that one was, but it was actually a pretty good conversation.
Yeah, you would think with that lineup that he had at the on the panel, you know, with, you know, you got Art Adams and, you know, man, Brooks, so many.
You
and, yeah, you got Tommy Lee Edwards. Mm-hmm. Who else was up there?
I'm trying to remember now.
What's the name of the panel?
Phil Noto.
Thank you. Yeah. It was the Variant Cover panel. I can't remember the exact name. But, yeah.
Yeah. I mean, between especially with me this year, between all of us, I think we've done every variant cover for every comic ever made.
Yeah.
You know, those guys, they do a lot of those variant covers. A lot of those guys, they do, that's what they do, period. I think Mark Brooks, that's all he does is cover work.
Oh, yeah, he made that very much, you know, he was like, oh, yeah, that's where things are. So,
well, I don't know if that's where things are, but I definitely know that that's what he does that. And, you know,
because the question came up was whether you'd rather do interiors or covers, and I think that was for him, that was... You know,
I think it goes down to, like, he can knock out so many variant covers, and I'm not sure what the pay rate is for covers, but it obviously is enough to where he's living, he's fine just doing that.
Yeah, I mean, there's a part of, and that's this most artists. I mean, and to each his own. With, you know, whether you just rather do covers, but I feel like your biggest growth comes in the storytelling. I learned so much with Runaways. I don't even think we talked about that, but not really. But yeah. I learned a lot working on Runaways. It was the first time that I did a miniseries. There it is.
Yep.
I learned a lot. I hadn't worked on a series or miniseries in a while because I just wasn't really into it, and I just didn't feel like I would do my best work if I wasn't really into the actual work. So, you know, that series really, I saw by the end of it, you know, and most people will say the same thing that do interior work by the end of their run of something. You know, it's a significant jump from the beginning. So I'm trying to keep that momentum. Mm-hmm.
Into your new secret project, right?
Well, into my
seen it.
Into my creator-owned project.
Something you'd like to plug now?
Yes, something I can mention right now. It's a Dark Horse book, actually. You know, going back to the guys that helped me get started. I did. About a year, 2 years ago, I did, when Dark Horse Presents relaunched, I did a creator-owned story in Dark Horse Presents called Rotten Apple, and a lot of great response came from that. They collected those stories into a one-shot, and that gained some popularity, and they wanted to do... Oh, wow, that's a sneak peek to the new story, actually.
Yeah, I was wondering, because I saw you tweet that, I think it was earlier today, or what have you, yeah, and I was like, I was wondering what it was about.
Yeah, so that's what that is. That's a page that I'm trying to finish right now, if I can get off this interview.
You're going to keep throwing that out there.
Yeah, man, I'm going to keep jabbing.
At this point, you're going to start penciling us into the panels, all right?
Oh, hey, you know what? Send me some images, man. You never know.
Hey.
Okay.
All you have to do is ask, right?
All right.
Find a nice headshot.
Of course. Of course, you're all gonna be like killed. So,
you know,
that's always the.
You know what?
That's the cool stuff. Everyone wants to be like, you know, eaten by a zombie or something in a comic book or whatever. But yeah, that's the one shot that I'm working on now. Called Rotten Apple. It's the second one shot that I did that I'm doing for Dark Horse. So that will be out. I don't know when exactly, but I'm doing that right now. And then, you know, honestly, I needed to get this done. Marvel wanted me to start on something soon, but I wanted to get this done before I did that, and they were cool with that. So
that's good to hear.
Yep. Yeah,
that's great.
And you also do children's, not to keep you into too much, but you also illustrate children's books.
Yeah.
Do you have anything on the horizon or anything you want to plug on that end? Because,
I totally didn't even talk about this either. Well, so the book that you guys are looking at right there, that's from a trilogy called Kulapari, which is an Aboriginal word for poison. And basically it's a story about these poison frogs, poison dart frogs, you know, the ones that are very colorful and exotic looking. These frogs, their poison protect all amphibians. And all the amphibians, you know, pretty much that exist, they all pretty much live in this land called the Amphibolands. And basically the Amphibolands is really just the outback, but we just, you know, called it that because it just sounded cool. And, you know, it was something that we can help children kind of see something that honestly really exists and see how awesome it is that it looks and feels like it can be a fantasy, you know, has some fantasy elements in it. Like the outback has four seasons that happen all at once, you know, which is really pretty wild. And so we wanted to explore those ideas with these types of amphibians and these exotic frogs. And so it's basically a coming of age story where you have all these exotic frogs, and then you have this tribe of just common tree frogs. And this young frog named Darrell, he is of that, you know, family or that tribe. but he also has what they call the clipart, which is very rare, that a common tree frog has the same element and the same ability and power as these exotic frogs. And they just, you know, it's an anomaly. So that's where the story really takes off. How did he get like that? Why is he like that? And it goes from there. The popularity of the book grew over the last few years, and we got an opportunity to turn this into an animated series on Netflix. So there's a Netflix show happening next fall next fall 2016. So, you know, just keep your eyes up for that. We'll be talking more about this.
Cool.
That was a pretty awesome opportunity just to see that developed and to grow like that. So,
all right.
Get to see your name in some Netflix credits.
Yeah.
you made that sound so like, I don't know, it's almost like.
I'm like, hey, that's.
Get
nice.
Your name in some Netflix credits. I'm like, oh, okay.
There you go.
Hey, there you go. That's it. But yeah, man, so definitely excited about it.
Awesome. All right.
Yeah. Cool.
Well, we've taken up enough of your time. As you said, you've got many things to get going on your Cintiq.
He's got pages staring up at him.
Yeah, actually, that was a reminder when he posted that page a minute ago. I'm like, oh, yeah, I got to get back to it.
Let everyone know where they can find you on various social media platforms, if you don't mind.
The various social media platforms are Facebook, Twitter, Instagram at Sanford Green. That's pretty much it.
Cool.
All righty.
We want to thank Sanford for joining us tonight. And like you said, make sure to check him out at Sanford Green with the E at the end.
Anytime you feel like coming on, please do.
Yeah, if you want to plug anything, especially creator-owned, because we always need to put that word out for the creator-owned stuff.
Absolutely, absolutely. Oh yeah, Rotten Apple. Like I said, that's what I'm working on right now, and doing some other stuff, some covers actually. Doing some stuff over at Boom. I think Boom Studios. I'm doing some covers for a pretty big property that they got coming up here real soon. Doing some covers over at the competition with DC. But that's some short-lived stuff. But then I'll be back over at Marvel. Pretty hardcore here shortly.
Cool.
All keep right. Our eyes out.
Definitely.
Cha-ching.
Thanks. Right. Thanks for joining us, Sanford.
All right, you guys welcome. Good. All right.
Yeah, take care. Be well.
All right. Have a good night.
You too.
You too.
Peace. Peace.
Later.
All right.
Cool.
Okay, you got 5 minutes for news. Go.
I was debating whether not to even do the news portion.
Nah, I was about to say anything that.
Wait, you got to do your plug. You got to do your audible.com.
Oh, we got to do the ad.
Oh, yeah.
Thank you. Good reminder. Sanford, in case you're still there trying to figure out how to get off, I think I can.
Yeah. I'm like, okay, what do
we're
I do?
We wouldn't say anything about you.
Do I sit here and listen in, or what?
Just be quiet.
You can listen to us while you work, and then just chime in and be like, hey, you got, you know, I agree.
That wrong.
Yeah, exactly.
So I was reading this horrible book called Runaway. The worst art I've ever seen at a time.
Yeah, and I will see you at a con somewhere.
Absolutely, New York, coming soon.
You too.
Don't come to Chicago. Don't come to Chicago.
Okay, I'm gonna jump off. But
do you know how to jump off?
Oh, this is so much fun.
Just hang up, right? All right, cool. All right, I guess send me the link whenever you guys are good.
Okay.
Got it.
I'll email it to you.
All right, thanks.
No problem.
Peace.
Peace.
Oh, there he goes.
Now we can talk about
it. That was a lot of fun.
Yeah.
Yes, it was.
He's a cool guy to talk to. So.
Yes.
Let's see what I want to do tonight. Do some Amazon script. Visit cspn.com or cspn.us, then click the Keep Our Podcast Free link at the top of the page. From there, scroll down and click on the Amazon link to shop. Purchase items from amazon.com as you normally would, whether it's books, music, electronics, jewelry, apparel, etc. For every purchase made on Amazon through our link, Amazon sends to CSPN a payment that helps us keep the Comic Book Chronicles free for our listeners at no extra cost to you. Amazon.com through CSPN.us. Do it today. Yes, we're going to fly through these new segments here. Michael B. Jordan in talks for vampire comedy Blood Brothers from Dark Horse. Okay, Marvel shakeup. Film chief Kevin Feige breaks free of CEO Ike Perlmutter.
Right.
Mutter?
It was a big deal.
Yep. There's some related news to this, too. I don't know if it's probably further down the sheet. They've also disbanded the Marvel Creative Committee.
the Imperial Council has been... Well, actually, wait a minute. Actually, because there was another one right after that saying it might not have been.
For real?
Yeah.
Oh.
Stay tuned.
Yeah, that may not be true.
Yeah, or they may reform it, you know?
I have no real thoughts on what that means, repercussions-wise, for the movie franchises. So...
I mean, my biggest concern, and I think what the fire that everyone was reporting was trying to stoke is that, what we've had so far through the Marvel's Phase 1 and 2 is that, there's always been like a strong, I don't want to say hint, but there's definitely a strong reminder of the source material. While they may make adjustments to make it more presentable on screen, they're still very much true. The movies are still very much true to their original stories for the most part. And I think what they want people to be afraid of is that, if there's no creative committee that's kind of keeping overwatch on this, the movie studio is going to run amok. I'd like to think they've come to a point where we can sort of trust them, but I still like the idea of having, like a lot of input from the comic side.
Yeah, it's one of those cases of, the committee knows the source material well, so it's whether or not they're given too many notes or not, and we really don't have any idea since we're not in the rooms during these conversations or whatnot.
Right.
Is it good having final authority or not? Like, is more power a good or a bad thing? Or Kevin Feige, or anyone.
Yeah, exactly. Matt Wang makes a point. There may now be a disconnect between movies and TV publishing, which, yeah.
They've been feuding anyway, so.
Yeah.
On the low. So. All right. Not the light, possibly.
Yeah, we're just... we're really skimming through the news tonight.
Yeah.
Pretty much.
Stan Lee, I guess, is going to be in X-Men Apocalypse.
Tony Todd is the voice of Zoom and Flash.
That's cool.
Candyman for Fall for...
Theo Rossi and Rosario Dawson coming to Marvel's Luke Cage. Theo Rossi playing Misty Knight, possibly. That was kind of cool.
Cool.
Wait.
Right?
No, Simone Missick.
No, Simone Missick.
Theo Rossi's a dude. Theo Rossi's a dude. Oh. What's you had me for a second there, Tim. You had
it's a whole new world out there. Brave new society.
I was like, what?
who is that Theo guy playing?
He's playing the villain, but I'm not sure.
No idea.
Okay. Oh, and Diggle from Arrow got a costume.
Magneto.
Yeah. His helmet looks like Magneto. With a biker jacket on.
Are you serious?
Yeah. Yes. I saw it I was getting my haircut this evening and saw it.
Oh, my gosh.
So, yeah.
Well, they've started filming the newest season of Agent Carter. That's awesome. Can't wait for that to come back. Let's see.
I'm in comic news now.
Cottonmouth in Luke Cage. That's about it.
I was just. I wanted to just see if there was anything there I wanted to shout out real quick.
Yeah. Dude becoming a regular on Steven Ryder's becoming a regular on Daredevil. I can't remember who that was. It might have been a cop, I guess. I don't know.
Mm. All right. So comic news.
DC announces DCU trades plus lots of classics for early 2016. DC President Diane Nelson to head up WB Consumer Products. Mark Silvestri brings Cyberforce to line Webtoon. The Top Cow Talent Hunt is returning.
Soon.
Oh, Gargoyles co-creator and Archer artist launches Marvel's Star Brand and Night Mask series where they're in college.
Oh my gosh.
Everyone's going to college. Empire State University.
That's funny.
Viz's weekly Shonen Jump arrives on Comixology and Amazon.
That's actually pretty big.
Coden Shah is also coming to, is also there already. Actually, both of them are already there to Comixology, which is like Attack on Titan and various other books, or a few other books.
Yeah, but that's pretty big that they're going to be on Comixology, and Amazon. Yeah. Now, in a much more readily available digital format.
And DC is also set to release an 800-page Gotham Central omnibus collecting the entire series.
Yeah, that's pretty cool.
Scarlet Witch is going to have rotating artists, which I'm not...
One of which was announced, I think.
I don't remember who it was.
Neither do I.
Firefly returns a new Serenity comics from Dark Horse next year. Weird World returns in a new series in December from Sam Humphries and Mike Del Mundo.
That's cool.
You about to say something, Roddy?
No, I was about to say that next one, if you were going to get to it, was not supposed to be there, but you didn't, so.
Okay.
That last one was a pretty good one.
Christopher Priest launches ebook with unpublished Quantum and Witty scripts in combative history.
Between the characters? Yeah. Or the combative history between Priest and whomever?
Have to buy it and see.
Yeah, right?
Any variant covers you want to mention?
The Daredevil, the action figure one's pretty cool. There's the whole, we finally get all of the, well, the so far at least, the hip-hop variants.
Like the first wave, probably, right?
Yeah, because it's like about 4 or 6 months or something going on, and that's like the first two.
Right.
That's, I think, about it. Yeah, I mean, that Star Wars one is all right, but that's, I don't think we're ever going to see it. So.
Hmm. All right. That's it. Time to review some books.
Yeah, let's get to it.
Who wants to... How was the end of Daredevil in the end of Mark Waid and
It was a nice wrap-up, because the lead into this has been kind of up and down for me, because I wasn't so keen on some of the supporting characters that Waid was introducing, like the Shroud. But a lot of that came because, you know, they had put Matt Murdock and Nelson and Murdock and Kirsten Duffy, the latest girlfriend for Matt Murdock, into San Francisco. And so, you know, they brought some of the supporting characters who have used San Francisco as a home base before, like the Shroud, or at least, you know, the West Coast. So, you know, this was a well-written ending. I do not recommend this particular issue for someone picking up Daredevil for the first time, because there's a lot of stuff going on in here that you do need a little bit of backstory for.
I actually read this.
Without having read any of the previous issues?
Exactly.
So how did you feel about it?
I was vaguely familiar with the fact that they had faked Foggy's suicide.
Right.
So I kind of knew that had happened. And I knew that his identity had been made public. But beyond that, I really was, you know, I didn't really know what else was going on, but mm-hmm. I felt like I could pick it up pretty easily. I wasn't confused by anything. Everything got explained, you know, as the story went along. The only thing that I felt down by was, especially towards the end of the issue, they kept pushing towards this press conference he was going to have to do.
Right.
And, you know, you're going to have to go out there, you're going to have to talk, and then he gets, you know, really worried about it for the first time. It's like, you're actually afraid of something. You got to face this. You got to go talk to these people. You have to explain what happened. And then it just skips right over.
Mm-hmm.
And that was the one thing where I was like, well, like, I figured there'd be like a big splash page of him saying in a podium and all this text, and I was gearing up to get to that. Like, what is this speech? This is going to be some phenomenal speech he's going to give. This is going to be the speech of his life. This is going to be the speech that defines the character. And then, nope, just shot of him jumping off into the city later that night.
I was just surprised that the world didn't end right there. That's what I was thinking when I turned
for
the
Secret
page.
Wars?
Yeah, exactly. I was just like, what, the world didn't end at this point? You know, because that was like a running theme through a couple of the, you know, obviously the last days books that have been coming out. But when I flipped to that last page, I was like, what, the world's not ending? He's just, you know, he's just going out and it's just the end. So that was the only disappointing part for me. Yeah, I kind of was looking forward to the press conference, but in the back of my mind was thinking they're going to end the world right when he's having the press conference.
Well, and the page right there at the end does like fade to white as it goes down towards the bottom. So it almost is like the Secret Wars end of the world.
Right.
Because he is standing there and there's like this huge white space at the bottom.
True enough.
The gap, almost like he did fade off into nothingness. But I don't know. I just like, I kept waiting for that speech and then it just didn't happen.
Well, I think that Wade's trying to leave something for the next right. You know what I mean? Like just like without totally he basically put a lot of the toys back into the toy chest, but for the whole, you know, like the true outing of the identity, you know.
Sounds like he ended it like the show ended, if he was jumping off a roof or something.
Pretty much.
Yeah.
Pretty much.
Cool.
But yeah. I mean, I liked it. It was just like I said. It was just, you know, It was a nice, neat wrap up to the, you know, to the series. It's just I've had a tough time getting to this point.
It wasn't like, hey, it's the final issue. Now we got to kill everybody off and put everything, you know, do like an Empire Strikes Back thing, so that people are going to want to come back for the next issue. It was much more of a much more quiet. Mm-hmm. You know, everything kind of winds down. Life goes on. Another day in the life. You know, as things just play out and move forward. So.
Right. Okay. Let's see.
Well, since we're on sequel, does anybody want to start from outside and go in?
So I only read one Marvel book this week, so.
Oh, okay.
Feel free to go whichever direction you want with Secret Wars.
Well, anybody outside of me read Silver Surfer?
I read it.
Okay. Well, let's go there then.
I read it. So this is, well, go ahead, because I have kind of conflicting feelings about this issue.
Okay. Well, they may or may not conflict with what I'm about to say, because it seemed like they have made some relatively smart decisions around Secret Wars, and this and having Silver Surfer outside of it seems to be one of them, as the one who is going to end up partially, well, I guess from the outside, shaping the world that is going to come.
Right.
So that whole part, I mean, granted that there was a slight logic leap to get there, but it wasn't anything that was outside of the realm of, you know, possibility in Comics 1. But that said, I've kind of enjoyed this book because of the fact that they have this going on. You know, on one side of this issue, you have, it's weird, but you have Don Green having the task, being tasked with reshape the Earth, which Dawn Greenwood, who has never been outside of her own little, you know, town place, is being tasked to reshape the whole Earth, you know, and the Silver Surfer is off creating the rest of the universe. And going into this, we see both sides of that. We see her trying to, you know, trying and failing to reshape the Earth as she knows it, which, like I said, she doesn't know a whole lot of it up right. until a certain point. And then we have the Surfer outside who recreates the universe, starting with the people they ran across during the course of this series. And up until a certain point, which I've got a feeling you're probably going to have the issue that
right.
your conflict is.
So I'm going to ring this. I'm going to ring the spoiler bell because I'm going to go into some of what Rod is alluding to.
Mm-hmm. No, I'm just going to go ahead and say it. So we get to a certain point in the book where the Surfer is pretty much rebuilding everything as it was until it gets brought up to where Galactus has to come back into the fold.
Right.
And then he goes and recreates Galactus and then just has a change of heart real quick and says,
right. Nope. This was the turn where Dan Slott kind of lost me in the story because we've come to this point in his telling of these Silver Surfer stories where he's, you know, come to grips with what he is. He's kind of expanding upon what he is. He's, you know, it's another way of expanding the Surfer's humanity, or, you know, like his depth of character. And we get to this point where, you know, the temptation is just too great for him to overcome, to just kind of undo all of his sins. And I'm like, wait, this does away with all of the character development that we've seen in the Silver Surfer since his first appearance.
Right.
And I that felt, you know, obviously it's a plot point. It's going to be resolved in the next issue.
Right. Because by the end,
right.
At the end of the issue, you start seeing where he's turning around on what he was like on what he was doing.
Exactly. So, you know, and some of the supporting characters who are in this are like, oh, there's something wrong. There's an imbalance in the Force. You know. Mm-hmm. So, but you know, it felt so odd to me when I read that. Like, wait, Surfer knows better than this. Why would he be doing this now? I guess because he's drunk with the power of being a god and recreating reality,
right.
You know?
And I think that's what they wanted to show. Because because even on the other side of that, you saw when Dawn Greenwood was recreating the Earth, she was talking to her father, mm-hmm. and her father was like, hey, could you bring back your mom, who apparently was dead? And she was like, nah, I don't know if that should happen or not.
Right.
You know, and then went off to do other stuff while thinking about it. So, right. And then we have the Surfer, you know, who ends up doing this on the other side of that, which is, mm-hmm. I guess, kind of a parallel in some way, shape, or form.
Exactly. So that's where I had, you know, that's where I had some issue, but obviously it's part of the story, so... Mm-hmm. You know, overall, you know, I like where Slott's going, you know, with the story. I like that he's introduced this sort of personality conflict between the two of them, how, you know, how they one is willing to draw a line with recreating reality, where the other, you know, the one who actually wields a lot of the cosmic power, mm-hmm. you know, already, won't, you know, is willing to cross that line and say, hey, you know what, I'm going to remake this in my own image, in the way I want it, as opposed to the way it was.
Right, which is curious to see how much that of that will or will not inform what actually comes out after Secret Wars.
Right. Okay, cool. Did who else read Thor's? Come on, peoples.
Right here.
I read that.
Yeah. Absolutely.
I put that on my list. I did read a Secret Wars book.
This book continues to be great.
Yes, this book is awesome.
Can this be one of the books that continues after Secret Wars? No.
I wish. They haven't said anything. I would like to. I was thinking about that the last couple of times because I was like, okay, I would want it to continue, but at what cost? And, you know, would it continue to be as good as it is now if that happened?
Even after I said it, I was like, yeah, there's no way it could happen, but man. Yeah.
If they could take one of the Thors, like maybe Ultimate Thor, and put him in a similar type situation, but instead it's just like an intergalactic police force. Mm-hmm. You know,
so
it's
it
not
would be Green Lantern. Force.
Yeah, but you know, this is better. And
good job, Dirk.
But if they could do that, it would have that same type feel, you know, where it's the police procedural, but you've got characters that can shoot lightning and call down the thunder and, you know, things like that, because that's what really makes it so interesting to me. Yeah. One thing is, I'm, you know, we're three issues into this, and we still don't have Ragnarok in here. I want to know where he's at.
You mean Klor?
Yes, Klor.
In our tweets?
Yeah.
Well, I mean, I thought it was great that, you know, in this issue we have... I'm not that familiar with the stories that have been told about the Ultimate Thor, and I don't know how Loki plays into that. So for me, it was interesting to see Ultimate Thor interact with at least a version of Loki that is very reminiscent of every, you know, kind of, you know, mischief maker that we know from the 616.
Yeah,
you know?
I'm pretty sure they're going to be making that Scully he wore.
So, you know, for me, that was like a real draw. Yeah, exactly. I was going to say this was a real draw for me because I don't recall reading the Ultimate Thor ever interacting with a Loki that was this kind of Loki that was like a Loki we'd be familiar with.
Mm.
So that was pretty cool.
I do like the way, though, that, you know, Loki is a character that intrinsically you cannot trust him, mm-hmm. but yet he knows something that no one else knows, and he's toying with them, giving them hints, giving them clues, mm-hmm. but you can never be too sure, you know, how much of this is the truth, how much of this is him playing with them, trying to maneuver them into a position, and there are things that, as the reader, we know. Mm-hmm. We know are true and not true, but there are still certain things that we don't know either. So how much of this is him playing on our expectations as the reader as well as playing with the characters within the story? It feels like there's another level of the writing going on where he's actually turning to us as readers and saying, you think you know a lot, so we're gonna, you know, confirm what you think you already know just so maybe we can tear it down later.
Right. This is where you start. This is the point where we start to see the cracks in the world, or we presumably see the cracks in the world hit Thor's, which has been the one mainstay that has really never, you know, been
every time,
like the other recent books.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, every time we see a crack in some other book, it's always the Thors that come and shut it down and mm-hmm. close it off.
Right.
But now that it's weaving its way through them, you know, you have this better idea of how it could all fall apart.
That whole interrogation scene was really great. I enjoyed that.
Yes. And by the way, just the, you know, there's a, without spoiling too much, I'll ring the bell. There's a traitor in the ranks of the Thors, and that, you know, that it's a presumably revealed in this issue. I thought it was funny that it came from a particular era of Thor where the book was not doing very well.
Hmm. Wait, a dirty cop? That doesn't happen.
Oh, no. That's funny.
All right. Well, it was a good book.
Yes.
Yep. Very good.
How many issues do we have left?
I assume one more.
Maybe just one more, yeah.
Huh. That's going to be a bummer.
I thought this was a 6-issue series. I could be wrong.
Who knows with Secret Wars?
Yeah.
That's true. That's true. That's true.
All right. So what else we got?
Anybody read Star-Lord and Kitty Pryde?
Nay.
Nope.
Oh, I'm the only one reading? Wow. How does that even
happen? I don't know wanting to, but I don't know.
I didn't get to it.
I mean, this is one that definitely plays up the comedy, and they played it up a lot in this one, actually.
There you go.
Yeah, surprise character appearance, which turns out to be not what you thought it was going to be. There's an Excalibur reference in here, if anybody read the old...
Floating heads. Yeah,
so definitely some good references being thrown in there. But also, you know, I wasn't really sure... how to describe this book other than that it's the rom-com of Secret Wars, because it really is the couple kind of thrown together and they bumble their way through it. They hate each other, but they love each other, you know, that type of thing going on. So it does play up on that, but it is very inventive, and it very much plays on the whole battle world being multiple versions of the same people, you know, running into them time and time again, and how they can be very similar and at the same time be very different. And that theme is something that, even though this is a lighthearted, fun book, it is woven very well into the story. So it works on a couple different levels, and artwork's good. It was fun. You know, it was just very enjoyable altogether.
And this is 616 Star-Lord?
Yes. This is the one that made it through on the art.
Right.
Yeah.
I'm gonna check that out.
It's definitely worth reading.
Mm.
Yeah.
It seemed like it.
Yeah, because like there's so many Secret Wars books out now that I've hit the point where I'm like, nope, not trying that. I'll read at least reading the first issue. It's like, nah, don't need to continue with that. Let this go. But Star-Lord and Kitty Pryde, I am going to keep reading until its conclusion.
Which is this?
That's the last issue?
Yeah.
Oh. Oh, no.
Even better. Like, there's the, was it Hail Hydra book? I still haven't read the first issue for it. Now I'm like, I'll get to it eventually, maybe. Doesn't help that Rick Remender's leaving Marvel, so I'm like, what's the point in reading this? None of his stuff will carry over.
You gotta see where it goes, man. Finish the fight.
I did read Plutona number one from Image Comics.
Okay.
It's from Jeff Lemire and I forget the woman's name. Her Twitter handle is Emmy Lennitz, artist. So it's about a group of kids in the world they live in. They're superheroes, and this group of kids come across the dead body of, I guess, their world's greatest superhero woman. So that's like the hook of the story. But it's really about just the kids and how they interact with each other and disagreements and whatnot. Them coming across the body happens at the very end of the issue. So, I guess Breakfast Club is a good, I guess.
Or like Stand By Me.
I was about to say.
I don't know if I've seen Stand By Me, so that's probably why I know.
What?
Really?
Come on, we should not stop. We should not be, we should, we've
been through this. We know Tim's not. I haven't seen
We Breakfast know that Club. A lot of movies Tim has not seen.
Breakfast Club, I just referenced, so that's another one. I see it on TV all the time.
We should not be shocked at this point.
So, another Jeff Lemire Image series I'm a fan of.
Cool.
All right.
And I guess I'll quickly throw out Etso Manowar number 40 from Valiant Comics. I'm trying to keep up with the Valiant stuff more nowadays. This is part two of Exodus story arc, where Etso Manowar's former, not villains, but former enemies, the Vine, have found their way to Earth. Except now, I guess this ties into the last summer's Valiant big crossover event, Armor Hunters, I think it was called. And I guess at the end of that, like, Etso Manowar made a peace treaty with the Vine, and a community of them come to Earth as like a place to live. But of course, you know, seeing big alien spaceships coming into Earth's atmosphere freaks out the government, so they want to attack them. But Arik, who is Etso Manowar, is trying to play peacemaker. And I guess during the Armor Hunters event, there was a military pilot that got a bunch of medals for his bravery, et cetera, et cetera. But now he's having like episodes because of it, because of all the stuff he experienced. So he's part of the contingent that's sent by the government to, you know, see what's going on with these alien ships coming into the atmosphere. And he starts having like flashbacks, and he like freaks out and he attacks first. You know, someone has to be the one to initiate violence. So he does it, and he does like a suicide mission and blows his plane up with a bunch of Divine. They land on Earth. They're not happy. They want to fight the military people, and it's basically Etso Manowar trying to play peacemaker. And then we also learned that there's a caterpillar agents of Divine that have been living on Earth for years, decades, centuries, whatever, kind of do their little secret invasion type storyline. But I enjoyed the art from Rafa Sandoval, who's been on various, I think, DC books and other comics over the last couple of years. Robert Venditti's doing the writing. And, oh, yeah, they also, going to comic book news, Valiant announced that Shadow Man is making his return in a Ninjak story arc. So that's Valiant news.
Cool. Well, speaking of invading military, We Stand on Guard number 3, which, yeah, I'm slightly, well, not slightly, actually I'm still kind of enjoying this book for what it is. It's kind of interesting. So here we have a book where, in a slightly red Donner situation, mm-hmm. America invades Canada and are still trying to take over territories. Presumably we find out it is because of water, but may or may not be the case.
It's because of Terrence and Philip, but anyway.
Stop sending us your Biebers. But yeah, we're at the point to the story where one of them got captured and is being tortured by future means, which means VR in this case. And, you know, the interesting part about it was like, okay, you don't know this until later on in the book, but...
Wait a second.
We find out at the point, but you know, to the extent of it, we don't find out. Now, the interesting thing about it is, like, you go through this really bad torture scene. Well, you don't really see all of it, but you see where things start. And the characters are being tortured, kind of go through stuff, until they said, all right, let's do some other means. And then, you know, pull out another...
another strategy of torture. Because basically it was a lot more psychological than physical torture, and that's what breaks the Canadian. I'm glad I rang the spoiler bell. I just wanted to, part of me, obviously, you know, we're supposed to be rooting for the Canadians because, you know, they're being bullied and annexed and taken over. But part of me is just like, get those damn Canucks! as I alienate all of our Canadian fans, expressed on the Comic Chronicles by Agent 70, are not the views of the entire show. Remember, please send all hate mail. Yes,
there you go.
That's Agent_70 on Twitter. I still blame you, Canada.
But that said, yeah, this book has still been is a pretty good read. We don't know what the end result is, but I should point out, if I didn't say already, this is an alternate future, but it seems like something that could at some point happen, you know, in this country. But you know,
that's funny.
It is what it is, minus the mechs in the future flying fortress battleships or whatnot.
Sure.
But the art's great on this, and the story so far is still. It's still interesting to me. So we don't get as much backstory on what ended up being the main character of the last couple of issues, but we're starting to see a turn for them and the groups and the group in itself. So we should see how that turned out.
All right. What'd you guys read? Oh, we're in rapid fire review soon. It's getting late.
Yeah, let's hit it.
Did anybody read the S.H.I.E.L.D. book?
Yes.
I was going to ask, yeah.
I enjoyed it.
I did too. This is a sleeper candidate for Click of the Week for me. I really dug this.
I hadn't had a chance to read it.
I actually read it as well.
Wow.
What did you think?
If you can believe that, I'm trying to find it. Where
it's under Mockingbird.
Mockingbird, S.H.I.E.L.D.
This is the cover I bought on it. Is the Phil Coulson action figure with the Deathlock Build-A-Figure.
Oh, that is so awesome. Very nice. So awesome.
But you basically get two stories for the price of one, because you got the Mockingbird feature, but then you've got the Red Widow first appearance backup story within this comic. And, you know, I got to say, I wasn't even sure I was going to read it. You know, it's just I collect the action figure variant covers. So I just kind of had it sitting here, and I thought, well, you know, I have it. I might as well, you know, slag my way through it and see if I can. But the thing was, I did enjoy the story because it is a murder mystery. I mean, that's what it comes down to. There's a dead body. She's trying to figure out why. And you get a lot of background on her character. You know, I'm not the most familiar with Mockingbird. I just kind of remember her from being in the sides of Avengers books in the late 80s, early 90s. And the fact Same that they reference her appearance from, like, 1971.
Yeah, her first
appearance. Oh, yeah.
The footnote there was interesting. But, you know, it made me like the character.
Sure.
You know, I enjoyed the story, and it's one of those things where I'm not sold completely on Phil Coulson S.H.I.E.L.D. stories, but he's, you know, on the phone in this one. He doesn't really even make an appearance, so I just like the mystery aspect of it, the whole CSI, Law and Order, you know, in the morgue, checking the body, looking for clues type stuff. So I enjoyed the story as far as that goes.
All right.
You were the biochemist, so that makes sense.
Exactly. What I was going to say is I was sold by the first two pages of this book, right? The first page being the summary page, which was great. I love the summary page because it gave you what you needed to know to jump right into the book. You know, it was the fact that it looked like a file card, you know, like an agent's file, you know.
The Manila file folder.
Exactly. What, you know, really made it, really sold it. And then you get to the first actual story page, and we're immediately kind of melding the TV S.H.I.E.L.D. show and the comic book. And, you know, without spoiling too much, you know, we immediately see, I believe this might be this character's first appearance in the Marvel Universe proper.
The British guy?
Yeah. I didn't want to spoil too much. That's why I didn't even ring the bell. But all right.
Come on.
Wait, which guy?
Well, Roddy hasn't read it yet, so, you know.
I mean, I've read it, but I don't remember a British guy.
You know, I'm
he's from the TV show, right?
Yes.
Oh, okay, never mind. I'm like, wait, what are you talking about?
I love it.
Anyway. And the backup story with Red Widow, mm-hmm. This is out of the pages of the upcoming novel Forever Red, which I've started. I still haven't finished it, but I can tell you that the novel opens with the assault that you see referenced on the last page of the Red Widow story. So on the last page, it's this little girl being rescued, Black Widow, taking out all the bad guys, and she's in like this burning warehouse, you know, being rescued, and that is the first two chapters of the Forever Red novel. So that's how they're going to tie the novel into the comic book series, is definitely that novel is going to be the background information you need on the character.
Got it. Interesting.
Yeah, I like both stories, the main and the backup story. Art for both of them was great, too.
Yeah, dynamic stuff.
Joelle Jones. I want to see her do more Marvel stuff.
It was dynamic stuff. I agreed. This, like I said earlier, when we first introduced the book, this is a surprise sleeper pick, click of the week candidate for me.
Huh. All right.
Broken World number 4. I think a couple of us read that.
Yeah.
It was I said in my notes that this was a more personal story. I'm not sure if that's like the right wording for it or not. I mean, there's nothing besides the events of the first book. There's nothing like, no super cosmic events or anything like that's happening mm-hmm. in the story. It's more down to earth, quote unquote. People dealing with the aftermath of
the world not ending.
Yeah, the world not ending. Perfect way to word it. But I know it felt like it kind of ended on just like a nice little quiet note. We never learned what the main character's dark secret was that kept her from not boarding the life raft or whatever they called it, ships off the planet Earth. I wonder if we were even intended to find that out or not.
No, I think that's a tease. Yeah.
I think that went into the conversation that we were having over, you know, it depends on sales. If the sales are good enough, then the character will come back, the story will continue. It just kind of depends on how much it gets out there. So you can throw in teases of things like that, and then hopefully, you know, you're whetting the appetite of the reader enough that they want to see the character return, and you've got some ammunition of where the story can go. But I don't think that was ever meant to be, you know, a plot line that we go through in these four issues, you know.
Okay.
It's part of the world building.
Yeah, exactly. That's what I was going to say. I think what we've got here is a first arc of a much larger story. And what they've created is, you know, I think a mystery where, you know, some people were meant to not, you know, were meant to stay behind. And I think that's one of the mysteries that Barbieri, you know, laid down, said, look, if we're going to tell any further stories, we're going to explore this. And I thought, I like that because it seems like maybe someone knew more than what they let on, you know, and, you know, there may have been some, you know, other conspiracies, you know, going beyond just people, you know, angling to get off planet. You know, so there's, you know, there's more to it. And, you know, I think that's that the seeds for that are laid down in this book too. So it's definitely an open-ended ending.
Alrighty.
Cool. Well, let me get to, if I can, Federal Bureau of Physics. Number 24,
Okay.
The last issue of this fine book that I thought was a fine book. So after the events of everything, I'm not going to go through all of them. Basically, the world's going to end because of some, let's say, machinations. That's not exactly the right word, but it seems close to it. but one character makes a sacrifice, but we also see before that some alternate reality meeting with his father, which is probably given away, but that's fine. We also see, you know, the book and almost a last days type of, not saying not a direct comparison, but
the Secret Wars. Yeah,
well, yes and no, because it's actually the last days, because you start to see the world kind of start coming to an end in various other places, like mm-hmm. you see the clouds come over and whatnot. But spoiler alert.
Hold on. I get the mouse over there. There you go.
A sacrifice has been made, and the world, as for the time being, has been saved. And the book ends off with a character I hope ends up coming back. It actually almost seems to come back, go back to the beginning, but with a new character. Because at the start of this book, we start to see the beginning of the world as you have this FBI unit for physics. And then it just started going off into this whole big story that ended up going, you know, with the main character, his father, and some other people around that situation, and the world itself being problematic physics. We get back to a point to where that's been resolved, and then we get to another character who's grown up 20 years later. I believe I've talked about this character before, Ina, who was probably like the smartest girl in the world at the time. Mm-hmm. And then we get to see her as an adult, you know, in the same capacity. So in that respect, the issue and the story ended pretty satisfactorily, because pretty much everything has been answered, with the exception of the stuff in the world, but they really didn't gloss over that in the beginning anyway, because there was some stuff in the beginning of the very book that could have been touched on, like politic-wise in the world, and some other, you know, other cases that they could have dealt with, but they did not. So, but I've been enjoying this book, and I've been, even in the change of art, which is still consistently good up until this point, was a pretty good read. It is not, you know, a standard superhero book at all. So for those who want something a little bit different, go back and check this book out from the beginning.
Would you be interested in buying this in a trade collection?
I probably would, yeah. I know I already have, like, volume one. Actually, I do have, matter of fact, the first trade of it.
Okay.
Already. So, yeah, I probably would go and get the rest of it.
Good. Sounds good. All right. Are we in rapid fire yet, or?
Yeah, sure.
Because I wanted to run through just a couple of quick Marvel books that I read. Age of Ultron versus Marvel Zombies number 4. We get the conclusion to the Robinson and Pew story about the Wild West, the 1872 Hank Pym coming to the rescue of this particular band of survivors who are in combat with the Marvel Zombies world and the Age of Ultron world banding together against them, and you know, we there's a lot of casualties, but we do have a satisfying ending. This is definitely one of those Battle World, you know, Secret Wars books that, you know, you could probably skip over if you're looking for something that's contributing to the greater narrative. You know, it tells its own story. It's okay. I don't think this is essential Secret Wars reading.
No.
You read this, Dirt?
Yep.
Okay. So, you know, it just ended. Go ahead.
Yeah, well, I was going to say, the one thing is that it felt like when you got to the end, as far as Secret Wars is concerned, nothing has changed. There's really no net
ramifications, no impact, right?
Right. It doesn't have anything to really do with that. And the one character who makes her appearance, she finally arrives at the end of this issue, just felt like it was one of those moments where the character pretty much comes out of nowhere and comes in at just the right time to make the save.
Right.
And it was a little, okay.
Well, right, I've been reading this since the first issue, so it's not completely out of nowhere.
Well, but she didn't arrive before the big battle. She didn't arrive after the battle. She arrives right in the middle of it and somehow fights her way through it
right, in
order to get all the way to the inside just as she's needed right there.
Mm.
You know?
I understand. The other book I wanted to quickly touch on was Silk number 7. And, you know, I like this book. I like the character. What's funny about this book is that this really truly feels like Secret Wars sticking its nose into a story, and we get to a point where it comes to an end, where the world is coming to an end, and we're in the middle of something happening to the character. If you're not familiar with the character, this is a spider character, spider-related character, Spider-Man-related character, who was locked away in a bunker by Gabriel? I forget his name.
Yes.
But the bottom line is she is the other half of the accident that gave Peter Parker his powers, and you know, she's now, you know, trying to forge her own path, and she's working for she happens to be working for J. Jonah Jameson, and at the end of the world, Jonah, of course, shows a little bit of heart. And one of the main arcs of the story is that the character Silk, whose secret identity is Cindy Moon, she's trying to locate her family, who she was locked away from by Gabriel when she manifested her spider powers. So what we find here is, spoiler alert, Jonah helps her locate her long-lost brother. And right as they're reunited, bum, bum, bum.
Is it the end of the world?
Correct.
How did I know?
So, you know, like I said, you know, my entire precursor to the actual review, yes, this definitely felt like Secret Wars jumped in right when the story, you know, when something was actually happening to the story. So it's definitely an abrupt end. I hope that I think Silk is coming back, but I'm not sure if I've read anything that confirms that. I would like to see this character continue on. It's nice to see an Asian American female character getting, you know, having a lead. As much as Sanford Green kind of, you know, said, yeah, you're probably not going to get too much of original art sales for this book. You know, I still appreciate the character. I'm glad that she exists. I want to see her do better. So hopefully, you know, this character comes back in a good way after Secret Wars, in all new, all different.
It is. Going back on that last book you were talking about, that was promising to see that other All New Invaders character on the cover. Hopefully that character will also see something after Secret Wars.
Right.
So.
Yeah, the same team's continuing.
On Silk?
Yeah.
Okay, good.
She joins up with the Black Cat.
Okay. Oh, that's right. I apologize. You know what? Sometimes we, you know, we see these solicits, and then, you know, until the books actually come out, we sort of forget. So I apologize. You're right. Okay. I think that covers everything I read this week. Everything that I feel like I need to talk about.
I got one more, but it's a throwaway. Oh, go ahead.
Oh no.
How was that?
Well, I was gonna let me hit the spoiler bell, because here's
All right. Spoiler bell. Here it comes.
This is not a versus book. This is actually a team-up book along the veins of, 48 Hours or those type things, where two guys who cannot stand each other have to work together in order to solve a mystery.
Somehow another bad cover is going to come in here at some point.
So this was actually a lot of fun.
Anybody else want a limp? Oh, no.
But, I mean, it was, you know, I mean, it's nothing, it's not groundbreaking, it's not going to bust open Secret Wars or anything like that, but for one of those offbeat type, two guys who can't stand each other but are going to have to learn to work together, you know, that's what it is. And that
is that a Ron Lim cover?
Yeah, this was
looks
a variant.
Like it is. That's a variant cover. That's pretty cool to see Ron Lim come back and do Thanos and Deadpool. Ron Lim, by the way, did half of the original Infinity Gauntlet series when George Perez was unable to finish it. And he did a long, long run on Infinity War stuff and Silver Surfer.
Okay.
The one other thing I wanted to talk about real quick was a hardcover that came out this week for Alien Salvation. This is from Dark Horse, and it's Mike Mignola artwork, Dave Gibbons story. It's a really nice hardcover.
Wow.
The problem is, apparently the original artwork is long gone, so they actually took the digital copy that has been around on the web that's selling on darkhorse.com and printed it out. So you can see, if you look closely on the artwork, you can see the colors, the way they kind of get manipulated when they go become a JPEG, especially when there's like bright yellow areas next to thick black lines. You know, you can tell as you look closely at them the way that there's that that artifacing where you've got the the little jaggies that come up and the colors don't blend quite right. And so that's you have that in this book, which is so disappointing. Considering the story is fantastic, the artwork is beautiful. This is one of these books when I was in college doing illustration, like this is one of those things on my shelf that I'd pull out and flip through every once in a while. And it's a shame that apparently the original artwork is long gone. They can't go back to it, but at least it's finally getting that nice hardcover treatment.
Cool.
Okay. All right, Roddy.
Well, real quick. Jim and the Holograms, number 6.
Nice.
Yeah, it was actually not bad. There was a there's a battle of the bands going on. Jim and the Holograms was supposed to be in it, which they were until something happened, and they ended up not being in it. But as things go, they still found a way to work around that, and there was still going to be some upcoming conflict between them and the Misfits. So,
okay.
The end. Pretty good book, though. Okay. It still has the feel of the show, for what it's worth. Not necessarily built for me, but hey, you know, like I said, this is a pretty good read.
Okay.
I've not seen that cover.
This is the regular cover.
Yeah.
This is the sub cover, and then this is the retailer exclusive cover.
Wow.
Yeah, that was what I've seen. Yeah.
We've touched upon Marvel, DC, Image, Dark Horse, Boom, and IDW now.
Yeah.
And I do have one more real quick, and that's John Flood.
Oh, I did read this.
I enjoyed it. It's weird. There's a larger mystery going on with the serial killer that he's trying to find. But while he's doing this, he's also solving these other small crimes, and he finds a bunch of cats that have been abducted.
Right. These small crimes are supposed to help solve the larger crime.
And somehow, like, I don't see how these piece together. But,
yet.
Right, exactly. But I feel like it is leading to something, especially with the way this book ends. You get this really, it seems like out of the blue, but if you're a super intelligent person who's always 5 steps ahead of everyone else, then it makes sense type of thing. And I just love the character. I love how goofy he is and how he seems like the type of guy he never sleeps, okay, is the thing. Like, he went through some sort of weird government experiment, and now he never sleeps. So for him, reality is some sort of dream state, almost, where he knows what's real and what's not real, but at the same time, the world around him just isn't normal like it is for everyone else. So he's an interesting character, and he's got a great sidekick, so to speak. And the way it plays out is fun, but it's one of those books where I feel like I almost feel kind of stupid reading it because I know that this guy is so much smarter than me, and Justin Jordan, who wrote it, is obviously super intelligent, and so I feel almost inadequate as I'm reading it. Like, oh man, I gotta start doing some research and go back and start reading Shakespeare, or I got the Christie novels or something, because he's operating on a whole different level. But it's a fun read. It's definitely a good book.
Well, what's funny is that it was weird because, just like you said, there's a smaller mystery that John Flood and his new assistant are trying to solve, and we get to this point where the assistant kind of lets us in on what the secret is. The secret is, the smaller mystery is supposed to help them with their bigger mystery, which is the serial killer. And if you recall, I don't want to spoil too much, but it's about the husband of the woman that they help. And when we get to the last page, what I think they're teasing is that we're rapidly getting to a point where there might be a confrontation.
Oh yeah, definitely.
So. I said, it was it took me a while to get into it, and I wish that Jordan had kind of let us in on why we were going through this entire story revolving around lost cats for that long. I'm like, why are we reading, how many pages of lost cats is this? And then we finally get there. It's like, oh, okay. But it was a bit of a slog.
Although I did enjoy the guy who turns out to be your villain for this issue, the guy who was the cat thief. And how he ultimately gets dealt with, not very satisfying.
Yeah, that was pretty funny. Free the felines! Oh my goodness.
So, all right. Yeah.
Clicks of the week.
Real quick before that, and I'm still trying to think of mine anyway, I got a couple of back issues. Ant-Man Last Days number 1, actually pretty good. I finally read that. And nice. Renew Your Vows, Amazing Spider-Man. That was actually pretty decent. Yeah. The what?
I said you're caught up now?
Yeah, caught up now. I was actually forgetting that. That last issue.
I think it's coming out next week, too.
Yeah, so cool. But, yes, clicks of the week.
I was surprised, Dirt, you didn't read Figment.
You know, I've got it sitting here. I just haven't had a chance to read it yet.
Okay.
Because it did just happen to have this cover as a variant. Which is another
nice! That's really cool looking. Holy cow.
So this is what I have sitting here right next to me to read later. But
nice.
As far as clicks go, again, it's one of those where it's almost unfair. Like, when this book comes out, does anything else have a chance?
Yeah.
I was going to say Mockingbird was very close for me. Mockingbird is very, very close for me, but I got to go with Thor's.
Yeah, same here.
Yeah.
Hello?
Tim?
Yeah, I had to take myself off of you for a minute.
It's like the three of us would jump there and we're like, oh, yeah, this is Thor's. It's all
Thor's. Yeah,
it's, just, it's funny because I totally forgot I read Thor's this week when I was doing my list. You know, I'm going to say that. I'm going to go the Mockingbird
issue. Yeah, because that was close. I really like that Mockingbird issue.
Yeah, I just read it yet. That's the only thing why I can't say anything about it. So.
Yeah, I don't want to, like I said, I didn't want to spoil too much of what happened. I mean, we did talk at length about what actually does happen, but, you know, without spoiling too much, I think it's worth the read, Roddy. And the backup story, the Red Widow story, is pretty good, too.
Yeah, and incidentally, as soon as y'all said British person, I knew who you were talking about, so it didn't really matter.
Well, you watch the show. So,
yeah.
You know, that's funny.
All righty.
Cool, cool. So, I love it. Unanimous. Almost.
Almost.
3 out of 4.
Happy belated birthday to Joe, Walt Simonson, and Jack Kirby.
Yes.
It was last week.
Yes.
And happy early Force Friday.
Oh, that's right.
And it's happy Labor Day weekend.
It's an hour, almost 30 minutes away before madness at your local shop.
I want that BB-8, and I want that Millennium Falcon drone.
That BB-8 is off the hook. Yeah. That's crazy.
Those are probably the best two I saw out of that whole spiel. So
I've seen nothing, so I don't know anything about knew about the Force Friday.
The BB-8 was all over Facebook the last couple of days.
Yeah, and the live stream is still out there on YouTube. But yeah,
Where are they live streaming?
Huh?
Where are they live streaming?
Well, technically, they were all over the place because they were, like, the main hosts were in, I can't remember where they were, but they had, like, as each time zone went into Friday or Thursday or Friday, whichever one, they were having people unbox stuff there at wherever they were. So they were, like, in, like, Hong Kong and Japan and Australia and, and
Thursday. Somewhere in Europe because that's where they probably just did it and now it's
about to get exposed. Right, and they got a bunch of popular YouTubers of their whatever area they're in to do, you know, to do the unboxing or whatnot. And for the one they had here, the last one they had here, which was at Lucasfilm or Disney, I can't remember where it was, but I think it was at Lucasfilm. They had Chris Perillo, which if anybody's been around, who's a tech blogger, who's this whatever. If you've been around for a while and know about tech TV, he was the one who unboxed that last the Millennium Falcon Nerf thing that they had. So, but yeah, and I can't remember, and you've probably seen the one with two hosts on StarWars.com if you've ever watched any of their little shorts or whatever, or the original content. So you've
that BB-8, $150 worth of goodness, man.
Yeah, yeah, that's almost worth it.
You're crazy.
Yeah, there's no way it's been that.
Are you serious? Have you seen that thing roll around?
Take a look at the thing. I'm
just at a point right now where I remember how hyped I was for episode 1.
Mm.
So I'm just everything's got to be tempered down a little bit.
Right,
fair.
Right. No, I that's fair. That's fair. Yeah. I agree with Roddy that you got to be fair with that. So, but at the same time, this toy, the design of this, because it's also designed by it was designed by the
Sphero.
Sphero, who did the droid for the movie. So you know that their designs are on point, and it's not going to be cheap because obviously they want to monetize this. So. And you can control it with your smartphone.
Yeah.
That is, seriously, are you not going to see that rolling down the street and try to snatch it, right?
Well, I'm not saying you're not going to see that rolling down the street, but...
Some moron in New York, some hipster is going to be in Williamsburg, like, I'm gonna run by and be like, whoop, I got this.
Yeah, that thing's like, yay high. Nobody's going to be going on the street with that. They are just wanting that to get snatched.
Yeah, seriously.
Yeah, I'll have to send me a link or something to it so I can see what this thing is.
If you go to News Nerds Need and go back to... There's been links.
There you go. No problem, too. We'll take care of you. All right, let's take it home.
So, again, thanks to our guest earlier in the show, Sanford Green, for joining us. Follow him at Sanford Green on on Twitter, Facebook.com, Sanford Green, Instagram, Sanford Green. Follow us on our social media websites, at TimDOGG98 and at CBCron. Website is theclicknation.com. Dirt is at PCN_Dirt, and his website is popculturenetwork.com. Roddy Cat is at Roddy Cat and at News Nerds Need, which he mentioned earlier. Agent 70 is at Agent_70. And if you liked guests on shows and you liked our episode this week, tune in next week when we'll have two more guests with us. Well, all about the guest interviews.
So there you go.
Stay tuned for that. There'll be more information next week when you know who will be on. But we are the Comic Book Chronicles, and we are signing off.
Hey! Would you believe it? It's Dr.